Everybody together?
Today is March 14th, 2017. This is a joint committee on Ways and Means, Subcommittee on Natural Resources. Senator Winters can do her schmoozing on her own time.
What schmoozing?
Oh, did I see Natural Resources? Joint Committee on Human Services.
It's like when you get on the airplane.
Whoa.
See what happened?
It was just a flashback, I guess. I don't know. So just everybody's paying attention. This is Human Services.
Yeah.
Today is a public hearing on Senate Bill 5526, the Department of Human Services. Before we open up that public hearing, I will turn it over.
Mr. Co-Chair, members of the subcommittee, so today is the first day that this agency will be before you, and similar to the Oregon Health Authority, they'll be here for several days, so you'll have a lot of time with them. There are materials and OLIS for the agency. There's today's agenda. There's also a copy of the LFO budget review document. There is a presentation from the agency. It's the PowerPoint they're going to be going through on the screen. There's also a document called DHS Supplementary Materials. It's a pretty lengthy document that has some program descriptions. It has a big chart that shows program eligibility and a bunch of other supplementary information. Some of this information will also be in the agency's three big budget binders that will be posted online. We don't have those in the system yet today. And then the last document is the quarterly business review scorecard. I believe they're going to cover in their presentation today. So you've got a few documents online to look at. So next week, just to kind of cast the stage ahead, overview today, aging people with disabilities programs the next 2 days. Then Monday, we had the long-term care ombudsman come in. That's a program that has quite a bit of nexus with that aging program in DHS, so we'll have them come in. A couple of days on intellectual and developmental disabilities, and then the Commission for the Blind will be in next Thursday. So we have a variety of human services programs and agencies coming before you the next 2 weeks. The next 2 days, we'll not be meeting in this room. We'll be meeting in H-170, which is the small hearing room right across from the LFO office front door. The Subcommittee on Education is going to use the room because they've got public testimony the next 2 days to give them a little more space for people to come in and talk about that budget. One last thing. So in terms of context, you're going to hear a lot from the agency about programs, needs for programs, budgetary needs, capacity to do work, and you're going to hear some stuff about the governor's budget. For context, I wanted to let you know, in comparison to the co-chair framework, the governor's budget is $183 million general fund higher than that co-chair framework. So just be aware that as you hear about that governor's budget, the co-chair framework really lays out a much lower target as far as a budget, general fund budget component for this agency. Just wanted to leave you all that tree note.
All right, and with that, we'll go ahead and open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 5526, and we'll call up Director Psyche.
So, Chair Steiner here, Chair Rayfield, members of the committee. Rayfield, members of the committee, off to a great start. members of the committee, for the record, Clyde Psyche, Department of Human Services, and with me at the table is Eric Moore, our Chief Financial Officer, and Tamara Brinkman from the Office of the State Chief Financial Office. So, when you said open a hearing on natural resources, I had that momentary, because I always have this nightmare that I sit down and start testifying and somebody says, hey, you're in the wrong committee. So thanks for correcting that. So we appreciate the opportunity to come before you and spend some time with you talking about the important work that the department does. You know, over the next couple of weeks, we're going to provide you with a lot of information. I would just tell you that if any of you offline want to have a conversation with myself or any of our program directors to dig deeper in some of the information we're presenting, we'll be happy to meet with you at your convenience. You know, really, our goal is to provide you with as much information as we can to help you make some of the tough decisions we know we're going to have to make as we craft the budget for the next biennium. So, as I said, today we're here to present you with a general overview of the department, and in subsequent meetings we'll have each of our five program directors meet with you and provide you with more detailed information on their specific programs. So if we go to the start, the first slide, really where it all starts for the department is our mission and values. You know, our mission is really why we're here. It really defines who we are and what we do. And it's really around the safety, health, and independence for all Oregonians. And these are themes you'll hear continually over the next few weeks as we meet with you. And then around the rim of the circle are the agency's core values. And these are the values that really guide the way we do our work, the way we interact with people, the way we treat people, and really kind of guide the way we operate as a department. So the next slide is an important slide because it shows that many of the people we serve receive more than one service. As you can see from the box on the bottom in the yellow, 35% receive at least two services, 20% receive three services, and so forth and so on. You can see from the box. And it really, I think, illustrates kind of the interdependence of our various program areas. We can have a family that's involved with our child welfare agency, and at the same time, they're involved with our self-sufficiency agency receiving Oregon Health Plan benefits or food stamps or SNAP benefits or cash assistance. And so really, when you look at a lot of the people we serve, you may think about making reductions or look at reductions in one area, and a lot of people don't realize that it has kind of the ripple effect. And if you make reductions in one area, it could very well impact people we are serving in another one of our program areas. I think one of the examples we always use is that financial security, financial instability, homelessness is a big stress factor on families. And when you have families who get in those types of situations, typically it could lead to issues around child care, or not child care, but the way the family is operating and the way the children are being cared for or not cared for. And so reductions in our self-sufficiency program could very well have an ancillary effect on our child welfare program. And I think it's also important to mention here, it's not just within the department itself, but also things that happen in other agencies could have a very big impact on the people we serve. For instance, reductions in the health authority, which impact the Oregon Health Plan and mental health services, could have a very big effect on the people we serve and their ability to function. So one of the things... Oh, excuse me.
Go back to the prior slide, please. So thank you for giving us a breakdown of the percentages. What is the number one service that people request most from DHS?
I think the number one service is in our self-sufficiency program, and it's the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, our SNAP program, which is really the food stamp program.
Okay, thank you.
You bet. So the next slide really speaks to kind of a direction we've started to move in and want to continue to move in. And there are two important things about this slide. I think in the past, if you looked at the department, we tended to think that issues we had to solve were really issues we had to solve ourselves, and we were the experts and we were the people who had to deal with the issues. And oftentimes we're hesitant to engage outside entities in helping us address those issues. You know, over the time I've been back with the department, I've come to the realization that if we take that approach, we're never going to make the progress, or we're never going to get the outcomes that we need to make. We really need to engage other state agencies, community organizations, local government, to really help us work on the issues that we face every day. And without that engagement, we're never going to be we're never going to achieve the kinds of outcomes that we need to achieve for people in the state. And it really means that we have to be a lot more transparent in the way we do work. We have to be a lot more creative. And to a certain extent, we have to move away from kind of this risk aversion that we've had in the past. And you know, we want to be very thoughtful and we want to manage risk. But I think if you are avoiding risk as opposed to managing risk, you're not going to be able to provide the kinds of services that you need to be providing. And so I just want to speak to some of the... Excuse me.
Representative Valencia Leon.
Thank you, Chair. So thank you for... I'm going to focus on number three.
Okay.
And I noticed that you have working in partnership with the K-12 system. Wouldn't you think that working with P-20, for instance, would be kind of more comprehensive? And is that something that you guys are thinking about and extending the work from not just K-12, but
sure.
also in higher ed, because we have, obviously, a lot of young people in school.
Yeah. Chair Steiner-Hayward, Chair Rayfield, and Representative Alonso Leon. So I will speak to that. If you look at the third line down in the SNAP 50-50 bullet, it's really about a partnership we have with the community colleges.
Perfect.
And so when I get to that, if it's okay with you, I'll work my way down the list and I'll speak to that. So since we're on the third bullet, let me talk a little bit about that third bullet. Those are just, I think, some examples of partnerships we have, not just with outside entities, but with other state agencies as well. We have been working in several areas of the state to partner with specific schools to actually have DHS staff in the schools. We've done it in Portland for quite a while. We actually have caseworkers, and in some cases we actually do eligibility out of the schools we're stationed at. We've recently, with Senator Winner's help, started a pilot with the Salem-Keizer School District, and we are working with three of kind of the lower-income schools in the elementary schools in the district. We have caseworkers there, and it's a little bit of a different model because our caseworkers there are really kind of serving as community resource people. They're helping to connect families with resources, not just within DHS, but within the community at large. And one of the things we realized, or we've come to notice, is that having people come into our office, if you're dealing with them in the schools rather than in our office, it's a lot less threatening environment, and people seem to open up and be a lot more willing to engage and work with us in the school setting rather than having to come into our office.
Senator Winters.
Thanks. Just to follow up, it's my hope that the work that both Director Psyche and our Salem-Keizer School District are doing in concert, that out of this will come a prototype that we can actually use in other places in the state. So I want to thank Clyde and Christy Perry and Salam for actually going forth with this project. And they will be collecting information in which to actually develop strategies for going further in the future.
Right.
Thanks.
So Chair Steiner-Hayward, Chair Rayfield, and Senator Winters, I think that's a great point, because one of the things I wanted to talk about is, and I'll come back to this, but just to kind of go off subject just a little bit, one of the things we're talking about is really giving our staff the ability to innovate and to try new things. I think one of the reasons the department struggles from time to time is because we know what the issues are, and we keep trying to solve the issues using the same strategies and same approaches. You know, it's that old saying, you keep doing the same thing over and over again and expect a different result. So we really are trying to give our staff the ability to innovate at the local level and to tell us what they think will work, and also community partners to give us that feedback. And we have to have some level of standardization across the state, but we also want to give people at the local level some freedom and some flexibility, because what works in Portland might not necessarily work in Klamath Falls or Ontario. Saying that, it's also a cultural issue, because I think most state agencies tell their staff, we want you to innovate, we want you to take chances, but don't screw up. And I think we have to realize that if you're going to innovate and try new things, from time to time, you're not going to be successful, and you're going to fail. Now, we need to manage that risk, but if people try new things and it doesn't work quite the way we think it should work, we have to learn to use those as learning experiences as opposed to opportunities to punish people because they weren't successful. So getting back to point number three, the second bullet, we have formed a partnership with the Oregon Department of Veteran Affairs. And what we do is we do data matching. In other words, we take the people they have registered as veterans, match them against people who are receiving benefits from our aging and people with disabilities division. And what we're finding is that there are some people there who are actually eligible for veterans benefits, which typically are a lot more robust than the benefits we offer out of our APD or Aging People with Disabilities division. And it's just been kind of a fascinating exercise because some of the people don't realize that they are veterans. And one of the comments we get is, well, yeah, I was in the service, but I never served in any kind of a combat situation. Mm. Well, you're still a veteran, whether you've done that or not. And so I think that approach has really been helpful in getting people the benefits they deserve and helping them be a lot more self-sufficient. The SNAP 50-50 program is a partnership we started with Portland Community College, and we've now replicated that in other community colleges and also working with some nonprofits on this. And what that program does is it takes people who are on our SNAP program who are attending colleges, and we identify those people with the college, and the college then provides some extra support to those people. And it's support as far as getting them into employment and training programs, job search training, and also working with them so they can get their GEDs. And so it's just that extra level of support for those people. And again, it's a program we piloted in one place, and because it was successful, we were able to replicate it in other places across the state.
Yeah. Representative Malmstrom.
Thank you, Chair. I had a question about the SNAP 50-50. There are these people that are involved, are any of them taking college credit courses, or are they all taking, you know, more of those courses where you're exploring things and doing GEDs and that kind of stuff?
Chair Steiner Hayward, Chair Rayfield, I don't know why I'm struggling. Chair Rayfield and Representative Molster. It's kind of a combination. It's really getting them involved with the community college so they can increase their skill level so that we can find them employment and that they can become self-sufficient. So it's really a variety of different circumstances depending on where that person is in their life.
Okay, follow up.
Please.
It's so they're not students that are trying to explore a four or trying to work toward a four-year degree particularly. I mean, they're not, because I know there's restrictions about doing that, getting food stamps. In fact, I'm working on a bill about that. But I'm just wondering, is this like a foot in the door to being able to do that?
So Chair Steiner Hayward, Chair Rayfield, and Representative Malmstrom. I'm not sure about the answer for that, and when Kim Fredlin, our self-sufficiency program director, is here. But my understanding is it really, with each person, we actually have a plan on how we move that person towards self-sufficiency. And I believe, and she'll correct me, I'm sure, if I'm wrong, that in some cases it is moving them on to try to obtain a four-year degree if that's the path to self-sufficiency for that person.
Okay. Thank you.
Yes. And then finally, our Aging and People with Disabilities program is working with the State Housing and Community Services Division to really work on a senior housing project in Prineville. One of the issues that I'm sure the committee is aware of that a lot of our people struggle with is affordable housing and the ability to find a place that they can afford and they can stay in. So the next slide is just a brief overview of our organizational structure. In the middle is the director's office, which are the people who report directly to me. Two things I want to point out is, number one, that our tribal affairs director reports directly to me. It's because our relationship with the tribe is very important to us. We interact with them on a frequent basis around Indian Child Welfare Act issues, but we've also started to really work with the tribe in our other four program areas. And in fact, we've started quarterly meetings with tribal human services directors and are looking for opportunities to partner with them and actually in some cases to see if they have the capability to actually run some of our programs within the tribe. And then also human resources director reports to me. You know, human resources is, I think, one of the most critical function in any agency, and that includes our training function within the department. But really, without having competent, well-trained people to do the job, we're not going to be successful at anything we do. And then over to the far right are the five program areas: Aging and People with Disabilities, our Child Welfare Division, our Office of Developmental Disability Services, which serves people with intellectual and developmental disabilities, our self-sufficiency programs, and our vocational rehabilitation program. And as Ms. Byerly mentioned earlier, you'll be getting to spend some quality time with the directors of these programs over the next few weeks. So I want to talk a little bit about the trends that are impacting our services. And these have a direct impact on our ability to achieve our mission and to do the job we're tasked with doing. First of all, we are seeing an increase in the people we serve in the aging and people with disabilities division. As the population ages, we're finding that there is a significant part of that population that maybe does not have the resources in retirement to actually support themselves. Looking at the trend line, and Ashley Carson Cottingham, our director, will be talking more about this tomorrow. We expect an increase in the caseload in this area. We're also serving an increasing number of people with disabilities, both intellectual, developmental, and physical disabilities. That's the direct result of the implementation of our community-based waiver, Medicaid waiver, or what's commonly referred to as the K plan. We see the demographics of the state changing, not just in age, but also in racial and ethnic diversity. We also know that the pace of economic recovery through the state has been fairly uneven. There are some areas of the state that are doing well, but other areas of the state that are still continuing to struggle and still have people that really need our help. We also see that some of the jobs that have lost during the last recession are not coming back, and these are some of the family wage higher paying job. A lot of the jobs we are seeing now are more are not really at the level that working one job provides you with enough resources to provide for your family. Housing is a continuing problem for the people we serve. And when you look at, it was funny because I was looking through the Oregonian yesterday, and they had an article about, they actually picked out five houses that were on the market. And when you looked at what they went for above the asking price, it was typically 30 to 40% above the asking price that those houses were going for. And then a big one for us, again, is the uncertainty at the federal level. You know, with Congress the House introducing the American CARE Act and looking at what some of the potential impacts could be on the state and not knowing what the final product is going to look like, it adds quite a bit of uncertainty to the planning and our ability to continue to provide the services that we do. So a little bit about our budget. Our budget for the 15-17 biennium was $11.26 billion. Each of the program areas are represented on the chart. I'm sorry. This is the 17-19 governor's recommended budget. I misread my notes here. And so in the governor's budget for 17-19, this was the distribution or the breakdown of the various program areas and how much of the budget they represent. When you look at our budget, I don't think many people don't realize that the majority of budget is really federal funds, Medicaid money, Title IV-E money. 67% of our budget.
Question, what, sure. And maybe you might get there, but what percentage of your budget is actually contracted services rather than direct services?
Chair Steiner Hayward, Chair Rayfield, Senator Winters. I'm going to look to Mr. Moore.
We'll have to get back to you.
Yeah, I have a slide later that kind of shows how much of our budget goes out to direct payments and services, and don't have a number for how much is actually contracted out, but we can get back to the committee with that number. So anyway, just getting back to the slide, the budget breakdown, 67% federal funds, 28% general fund, and then 5% other funds. So, Senator Winters, to get partly to your question, the next slide shows you that 51% of our budget goes to direct payments to providers, 25%. I'm having trouble. Oh, thank you. I'm having trouble. 25% direct payments to clients and 17% direct client services. So really about 93% of our budget goes out in direct payments and services, payments to contractors, payments to clients, and payments to providers. Thank you. I want to talk a little bit about outcomes and metrics. Because I think that's an important part of the discussion. So I will tell you that the department has a lot of data. One of the things we've struggled with is the way we use that data and whether or not we were using data to help us manage our programs. So we have a quarterly business review and a scorecard that we use to track metrics. And when I first came back to the department in November of 2015, and I sat in on my first quarterly business review, it was probably one of the most painful meetings I've sat through, basically because it became readily apparent to me that this had become a check-the-box exercise. Everyone reported on their metrics. There was no discussion. People were on their iPhones or doing other work. And the only one who was paying attention was probably me and the person who was making the presentation, which really kind of told me that, you know, again, gathering a lot of numbers but not really using it to manage. So one of the questions I asked our people is, so how often do you look at this? And people were pretty honest with me, and they said, we look at it quarterly to get ready for the QBR because we know we have to report on it. And so the conclusion I reached is, if that's what you're doing, then you have the wrong metrics. Because really, if you have the right metrics, you should be looking at them at least every other week and monthly at a minimum. And so what we did is, the way this is structured is, we have three levels of metrics. We have tier one metrics, which are the department-wide metrics. And I think we might have posted this to OLIS, and if not, it will be posted to OLIS, and it kind of looks like this. And there are five specific areas, and each of the programs have metrics in each of those five specific areas. Tier two are the division level metrics, which are the five program areas. So we have tier two metrics specific to child welfare, seniors, people with developmental disabilities. And then the tier three metrics are the really program area metrics and really metrics we use at the district or the field level. So we've spent probably the last 9 or 10 months really kind of digging down and working on our Tier 2 metrics, because these are the metrics I think are critical, because they really tell the divisions or the major program areas whether or not they're getting the outcomes and whether or not they're making progress. And it also informs them of the areas that they really need to focus on, where they're having problems. So I just want to give you a couple examples. So the first slide is one of our child welfare metrics, and it's children safely maintained with parents. And so just to kind of walk you through how this works, so this is kind of an aggregate measure at the Tier 1 level, and what I'm showing you is a Tier 1 level. And it really is a measurement of two groups of people, people who we haven't taken into care, but we're working with the families to make sure the children are safe. And then children we've taken into care, but then have returned back to their families. And so we're tracking to see whether or not the children are safe once we return them home, or if we're working with the family and haven't taken the children into custody. So at the Tier 1 level, it's kind of an aggregate score. At the Tier 2 level, we measure both groups separately, because we could be doing very well in one setting and not as well in another setting. And so that allows us to really focus in on, we're doing okay here, not so well here. We really need to focus on here, this group rather than this group. And then at the Tier 3 level, we break it. We can actually break it down by districts and say, looks like we're doing really well in Multnomah County. We're struggling in Malheur County. So let's work with the people in Malheur County to see how we can improve their performance in this area. And so that's just kind of a general overview of what we're putting in place and the way we're trying to look at measuring the work that we do. So then the next slide is just another example. And this is in a case in APD where our Tier 1 measure is also one of our key performance measures. And it's important to us, and so we measure them both at the same level. And it's really around how many long-term care residents we have living outside of nursing facilities. And we are one of the leaders in the nation in not having people having to live in nursing facilities and being able to stay in their homes or smaller settings for longer periods of time. Okay, all right. Moving on quickly. So what I want to do real quickly is walk through the five major program areas and just at a very high level, because as I said before, each of the program directors will be coming before you in the coming weeks and will be able to give you a much more detailed and in-depth look at their program areas. So the first area, and you'll be hearing from them tomorrow and Thursday, is our Aging with People with Disabilities program. And actually, Carson Cunningham is the director. And if you look to the right of the picture there, their mission is set out. They provide services and supports, early intervention, that help maintain independence, promote well-being, honor choice, respect cultural preferences, and uphold dignity. And then we thought it would be important for you to get a perspective on what their part of the budget is. So the services they provide are roughly about 30% of our budget, or $3.42 billion in the governor's 2017-19 recommended budget. Key programs in this area: adult protective services, licensing, and long-term care. Really, our charge in APD is to ensure the safety and protection of the children, of the people we serve. Really, when I first came back to the department, one of the reasons the governor asked me to return to DHS is because of concerns she had around the safety of children. And we had a few incidents in our child welfare department with providers in foster care that kind of precipitated my coming back. But in talking to the governor, it's really not just about the safety of children. It's really about the safety of all the people we serve. We serve some of the most vulnerable people in the state of Oregon. And our focus has to be on the safety of every one of those people, not just a specific group. And so we've done a lot of work in this division around safety. Probably have taken a lot more aggressive stance on making sure that seniors and people with physical disabilities are safe. You know, we have a lot of great providers, people who provide a very high level of care. But I will tell you, in some of the cases I've seen, these are things that keep me up at night, that we've had people who have experienced some of the things they've experienced. And so, in my opinion, this is a very critical area.
Yeah. Sarah Gilzer.
Hi, thank you. Clay, do you feel like you have the tools that you need on the APD side in terms of civil penalties and fines to deter recurrent bad actors?
So Chair Steiner-Haber, Chair Rayfield, and Senator Gelser, thanks for that question. We have some tools. We could certainly strengthen those tools. We, as you know, have had discussions with you other members in the House on how we can strengthen some of the fines and civil penalties. We have some of the lowest fines and civil penalties in the nation, and so they're not much of a deterrent. You know, I've actually been involved in proceedings where I've heard providers say, we'll just pay the fine. And, you know, that's not really what it's all about or what we're after. We don't want them to just pay the fine. We want them to pay the fine, but we also want them to correct the things that they should be correcting so that people are safe. And so we are trying to do some work around that. And again, you know, it's really easy to focus on the part of the provider community that is not performing well. But, you know, I just want to go on record on saying that many of the providers we do work very hard, are very dedicated, and provide a very high level of service. That being said, it's our responsibility to make sure that the people who aren't doing that are held accountable, and they either have to correct what they're doing, or, you know, quite frankly, we need to make sure they're not a provider anymore.
And may I follow
up? Please.
Do you know, Clay, thank you, Mr. Chair, do you know off the top of your head what the fine would be for a rape or a serious physical injury?
So, Chair Steiner-Haber, Chair Rayfield, and Senator Gelser, I don't know right off the top of my head, but I know we did a dry run with ABD, and Ashley has several slides that outline all of that, so she'll be able to provide you with that information tomorrow or on Thursday.
Great. Thank you.
Yeah.
Please continue. Oh, Senator Winters.
Just to follow along there, and my question is about capacity and looking at the whole range of providers. And I know that there's been, you know, a lot of discussion, everything from rates to actually whether or not we've done our due diligence in following up and holding individuals responsible. Is there a capacity issue, number one? And number two, is there a rate issue?
So, Chair Steiner-Haber, Chair Rayfield, and Senator Winters, I guess it depends on who you talk to. you know, for the typical people we serve, we don't typically struggle with capacity on the aging and people with disability side. Now, the same is not true on the child welfare side. We have some capacity issues on the developmental disability side. And we definitely have been struggling and have some capacity issues on the mental health side. And that's an area we've really struggled with. And Lynn Saxon and the health authority people have been great partners in this, but it is an issue we face. So it really is about what particular population you're talking about on whether or not we have a capacity issue. And in the governor's recommended budget, we hadn't requested a rate increase on in the APD budget, but we have had requested a rate increase on the DD side and on the child welfare side for our behavioral rehabilitative services providers and for foster parents.
Okay.
because we really haven't had a rate increase for foster parents for about 10 years now.
Please continue.
Okay. So again, the first bullet, I think, is something we've really focused on and something that's really critical to us, and it's really to ensure the safety and protection of the people we serve. You know, another important part of the APD program is really the choice and self-determination. We, as to the greatest extent possible, allow people to choose what setting they are going to be cared for in or reside in, and to the greatest extent possible, allow them to make as many decisions as they can safely make. And I think that's an important part of the program, you know, because when you talk to people, anyone's preference would be to try to be as independent as possible, try to stay within their home, as opposed to being moved into a facility or a nursing facility or that kind of a setting. And so this is a critical piece of that program. We also invest in preventative services. So again, we can keep people as independent as possible, but also keep them safe. And we also really work with providers to try to develop their expertise and skill so that we can provide the highest level possible. Because the other piece about people we care for, if we're caring for them outside of the home, you know, for me, it's not just about safety. It's also about quality of life. You know, you can keep people safe and keep them locked in their room for 10, 12 hours a day. But I firmly believe, and my program directors believe, that people who we care for are entitled to the same quality of life that any of us here in this room are entitled to. The next program area is our Office of Developmental Disability Services, which serve people with intellectual and developmental disabilities. Our system supports people with intellectual and developmental disabilities. It's got to be a simple system to use and access, be responsive to the strengths and needs of the individual, and really treat those people and their families as valued members of the community. And Lilia Tennedy is the director of that program. And the next slide, again, shows you it's about 24% of our budget, or about $2.71 billion. So again, recurring theme, safety, health, and well-being of the people we are caring for. Much like APD, choice and self-determination to the greatest extent possible. Integrating people into community settings, again, not isolating them, making sure that they have the quality of life and experiences that everyone's entitled to. Lily is going to talk a little bit about the Employment First Initiative, which is a initiative to get people into integrated employment in the community, so really offering people with intellectual and developmental disabilities the same type of employment opportunities that everyone has. And then also working with individuals, families, and advocates so that they have a major say in the services that they receive. Next is our vocational rehabilitation program. Trina Lee is our director. And in this program, we assist Oregonians with disabilities to achieve, maintain, and advance in employment and independence. This is one, our smallest program. You want to flip to the next slide here, Eric? And really represents about 1% of our budget, about $114 million. But just because they're kind of one, our smallest program, they perform a very key service. And they really are part of the state's workforce system that really works to meet the needs of people who have very complex issues that have prevented them from reentering the workforce. They're also part of the Employment First Initiative. We work very closely with youth around the state to make sure that they're prepared to enter the workforce. And again, we try to give customers or the people we're working with a major say in how we're working with them and to define the goals that they're trying to achieve. Next, there's our self-sufficiency programs. And these programs provide a safety net, family stability, and connect careers to guide Oregonians, and connection to careers to guide Oregonians out of poverty. They are, again, are a fairly major program in the department. They make up, 28% of our budget, about $3.18 billion. Dollars over the course of the biennium. So here's where we have programs that impact a lot of people in the state of Oregon. And the major programs are the food assistance.
Chair Steiner Haywood. Going back to the goal and to lift individuals out of poverty.
Right.
And if I was to ask, or if you're keeping track of the numbers of individuals that actually have become self-sufficient, what would that number be?
So, Chair Steiner Hayward, Senator Winters, I don't know that number right off the top of my head. But what I'd like to talk to you about is, and Kim Fredlin, our director, will talk to you about this. You know, one of the major programs within the self-sufficiency program is our employment and training program. And in the past, the goal of the employment and training program was to find a job for individuals who were working in that program. And as long as we found them a job, it doesn't matter if it was a minimum wage job or sub-minimum wage job, we would count that as a success and say we found that person a job and got them off the rolls. Well, you can say that, but does that truly lift the person out of poverty and really allow the person to become self-sufficient? And the answer to that, of course, is no. So over the past year or so, we've changed the focus of the program. So it's not really about the first job we get the person, but it's really about the long-term goal of that second or third job that will actually allow the person to become self-sufficient and really allow the person to function on their own and be lifted out of poverty. So I don't have an exact number for you, but we can get that, and then Kim will also speak in more detail to that when she presents to the committee.
Follow up. I'm asking this because basically budgets are predicated on caseloads. And if caseloads never go away, but we only add to it, that particular growth becomes so totally unsustainable, mm-hmm. and we never reach our objectives. It seems to me that somewhere in the matrix or somewhere in our outcome that we need to be moving towards the actual stated goal that we're actually, saying mm-hmm. to individuals, this is what we're about. And so if it is, that we're actually making the family where they are sustainable, at some place in that, it seems to denote where is the success or when are we successful.
Yeah. So, and Chair Steiner here at Senator Winters, that's exactly the direction we think we have to move in and that we're moving in.
Follow-up. My other question, because you and I have had these conversations, and that is the conversation of training, and I hope mm-hmm. somewhere in the presentation when your HR person come that we do talk about training of staff at all the various levels, particularly when we're talking about the eligibility and entry level.
Yeah. So Chair Steiner Hayward and Senator Winters, we are going to talk about training when we talk about our central services, but you'll also hear about training in each one of the presentations because we know that has been an area that we haven't devoted as much resource as we should have, and I think that's one of the issues of why we are where we are.
Thank you. Good.
Okay. Good. Representative Alonso Leon.
Yes. thank you, Chair. I also wanted to, and I think there's a presentation that was presented at our higher ed committee meeting around services, and I always think about in order to help people find jobs. You said it correctly. Finding them a job is not enough, especially if you have a family, or even by yourself, because housing is so much more expensive.
Yeah.
The cost of living is so much more expensive. A minimum wage job can only get you so far. And I, you know, as an educator, I always think about what can we be doing better to make sure that the people we want to help also gain skills, also have the opportunity to go to college. And I am a global thinker around education, that it's not just let's get them into a four-year institution, because that doesn't make sense for everybody. You know, how are we connecting people to apprenticeship programs, career technical programs, all the opportunities in the spectrum of education, so that folks know that in order to sustain and help themselves out, that this is one way, not the only way, but a way. And how are these two agencies working together to make sure that that's happening and that's being promoted and encouraged to segments of our population who maybe in their mind they don't think it's a possibility, but that if we provide that as an opportunity, they start thinking broadly.
Yeah. So Chair Steiner Hayward and Representative Alonzo Leon, I couldn't agree with you more. And this is one area where I know one size does not fit all. You almost have to tailor it to the individual, because individuals have different desires, different interests, are at different places in their life, and will need a different level of support to achieve what their goal is. So we realize the importance of working with the Department of Education, with higher ed. We also work with the Employment Department, and we have to work with the local workforce investment boards, because really it takes that kind of collaboration, partnership, that consortium actually working together to actually be able to provide people with the opportunities they need so that they can get off the program, and not just get off our programs, but stay off our programs.
I'm going to just pile on a little bit with a request. When Ms. Redland comes to talk with us about self-sufficiency, I would appreciate if she brought in a clear understanding of what your all's definition of self-sufficiency really means. I hear what you're saying about getting to that second or third job, which actually can maintain them, but I'd like to make sure that we all have a common understanding of what that term means.
Okay. Chair Steiner here would be happy to do that.
Thank you very much, Mr. Sykes.
Okay,
please.
So really, if you look at our self-sufficiency program, it's around family engagement to help Oregonians achieve their goals as they define them. One of the moves that we've made here is really up until not too recently, we were an eligibility agency. And really what we trained people to do was determine if people were eligible for benefits, make sure they were getting the benefits, reassess them at given periods in time. We're making a shift with part of the workforce, and again, Ms. Fredlin will talk about this. It's really around having these people be coaches and counselors to people so we can move them towards self-sufficiency. So some of our staff are being retrained and are playing a different role now. It's not just about eligibility. It's about how do we move you along the spectrum so you become self-sufficient and get off of state assistance or our programs. And really, you know, we are the safety net. This program is the safety net. So they provide economic stability to help Oregonians meet even their most basic needs. And then really, again, talking about developing those partnerships, those consortiums. So we're working together with a wide range of stakeholders and providers to make sure we're kind of providing a holistic approach to how to get people to where they need to get to. And then finally, an area that I've spent quite a bit of time in since I've been back is our child welfare program. And again, it's really we work to keep kids safely in their home whenever possible. And if it's not possible to keep them in the home, make sure that we have a safe and appropriate placement for that child. And so child welfare is about 9% of our budget, $1.05 billion. The key program areas, flip the next one with Eric, child protective services, substitute care, adoption and guardianship services. And the bullet points, I think, are really critical bullet points. You know, we really need to ensure a safe and swift response to abuse, have safe and appropriate, and that's a key word, appropriate placements for children, not just a placement for a child, but the most appropriate placement for a child. Really work hard to reduce the number of kids in foster care. We have one of the highest rates of kids in foster care in the nation, and we really need to address that. You know, really reaching out to the
Thank you, Chair. Why do you think we have such a high rate of kids in foster care?
You know, we're digging into that, but I think one factor is, again, we're a very risk-averse agency, and so if there's any, even an inkling that there could be an issue, we default to the position of taking the child into care as opposed to saying, what can we do to ensure the child's safety and have the child remain in their home? And so that's, I think, kind of a cultural issue that we need to change. And you know, I will tell you, for our caseworkers, it's one of the hardest decisions they have to make, because if they don't take the child into care and something happens to the child, you know, there's consequences associated with that. But then it also can lead to the fact that we have a high number of kids into care. And so it's really providing our caseworkers with the training and the tools, so that they can make the right decision. And I will tell you that, in my opinion, we have not invested enough in our staff, and we need to fix that.
Yeah. Please.
Can you give me a sense of the best in class in terms of states that do child welfare the best?
Eric, you know. So, Chair Steiner Hayward and Representative Bueller, I can give you a couple examples, but off the top of my head, I don't have that for you. I apologize.
I'm sure there's some rating.
There are.
Yeah. If you just provide that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Representative Alonso Leon, and then Senator Gelser.
Thank you, Chair. You mentioned earlier in your presentation that child welfare is an area that we're not at capacity as far as having enough staffing. When your director comes in to speak to us, can you let her know that we'd like to know, or I would like to know, where we're at with capacity, and what are the numbers that are lacking? Like, how many more people do we need to meet the needs of both our foster children and the parents, foster parents? Because I think that'll give me a good understanding.
Sure.
You know, when we're looking at either putting more money into an agency, I need to know what it is that we need for.
So, Chair Steiner Hayward and Representative Alonso Leon, so based on our current workload model, the last time I looked at it, we were at about 82-83% as far as internal staffing to child welfare. And in the governor's recommended budget, we had an additional investment in bringing that number up. But we can give you some specific numbers and specific examples of the types of staff that we would need to increase our capacity.
Follow up.
Yep.
So some of my constituents who work for this department have a different perspective. And so that, you know, the 82% is higher than what I'm hearing from constituents who work for this office. And so this is why this information is really important.
Sure. Yeah, we'd be happy to bring that.
Thank you. Senator Gelser?
Thank you, Manager. A couple questions. Just following up on that one, I think the interesting point would be the difference between what we're funded at and what's actually staffed. So if we're budgeted to 83% or 82%, but we're only able to keep people in so that we're staffed at like 60%, it would be helpful to see those two pieces, along with both a statewide and by district average length of tenure for caseworkers and CPS workers right now, and supervisors as well. And then follow up, actually, a different question. So one of the bullets, your top bullet, is the safe and swift response to abuse. And I'm looking at the summary scorecard that you have. And the summary scorecard shows that only 65% of the time are the percent of calls assigned for field contact in time. So a call goes into the hotline to go out and to see them. And that only a third of the time are the investigations complete within the timelines. And at the same time, we're hearing, or I'm hearing, and we've heard in another committee, concerns from defense attorneys, child abuse medical assessment centers, CASAs, and district attorneys that differential response is putting kids at risk and that the capacity in the program isn't able to be there. Do you think it makes sense to continue investing millions of dollars in consultants and outside contracts when we don't have the basic capacity to do face-to-face casework, investigations, training, centralized hotline that would seem like they would be the underpinning of an effective and safe differential response program?
So, Chair Senator Hayward and Senator Gelser, thank you for that question. My view is that we really have to go to school and dig down into the data and have the data tell us why we're getting the results we're getting and what areas we really need to pay attention to. And then based on that analysis, that's where we need to make the investments. But my underlying premise, and we've had this discussion before, is that we need to really prioritize the work and really focus in on the things that are going to address the issues we have around safety with kids. And I think there are different ways to approach that. We're having a lot of discussion about some of the methods we use and some of the tools we use. But the bottom line for me is when we make the decision, it really is going to be, for me, what are the prioritized things we need to do to make sure the kids are safe?
Can I follow up? Thank you. And so let me ask it in a in a different way. The level of concern from the community is very, very, very high. The stories that I hear from your staff offline in the branches and in other places are deeply concerning. We have a couple of certs that identify, you know, maybe it's not differential response itself was the ultimate factor in a fatality, but certainly was part of leading up to a lack of urgency around meeting those kinds of needs. We had testimony from a medical abuse assessment center that saw their numbers dropping by half in the first year. We had a DA talking about going from 50 cases a month to 5, even though calls to the hotline were going up. Does it make sense to keep putting kids at risk and continue rolling out and doing differential response before we have the answer to the question of whether or not we can do that and keep kids safe?
So, Chair Steiner Hayward and Senator Gelser, let me try to answer your question this way. So, I have heard from people who have concerns about differential response. I've also heard from people who say it's a good model and we should continue forward. So there's opinions on both sides of the spectrum. The tribes that we've worked with have really liked the model. Casey Foundation supports the model. Our federal partners have told us when we said we're going to start moving forward again, have said that they are supportive of that move. To me, differential response, when we have that discussion, it's not about the tool itself, because I think it is a good methodology. It's about our capacity to implement the tool and the way we implement the tool. So to answer your question in maybe a different way is, I want to make sure that we are solid on the fundamental things we have to do and then layer differential response on top of that, because it will get us a better result. But we have to be comfortable that we are doing just the fundamental things that we should be doing. We are doing them competently and correctly.
And one final comment.
Okay.
So I agree that differential response itself is the idea is a nice idea. But we don't, I mean, the data shows, our outcomes show we aren't doing what we need to do, and it seems like it's putting a hot tub in the backyard before we have running water in the house. And in this type of a budget environment, it seems like the place we should be investing is in caseworkers. So I hope that we'll have the opportunity to really dig deeply into that as we move
forward. Well, we'll look forward to seeing Ms. Al-Husseini in here, and we'll have some more of those conversations with her. Senator Weirs.
Yeah, just because I'd like to kind of put things in, because there's some pieces that go along with differential response that I want to make certain that when your program director come that we talk about. And part of those pieces is actually what's going on in the recruitment mm-hmm. and retention right. of foster homes. And I continually to bring up training because I understand, having been there, that unless we provide the tools to our staff to where actually when you, to me, differential response, if I was back in the agency and Children's Services Division when I was there, it's good old-fashioned casework, and I just need to put that out there. Because actually you're doing the assessment on the front end to determine really where is the placement mm-hmm. and what services are needed for the child and the family. So I but also in part of that is the community and those partnerships and resources that also have to be there. So when your person come, I hope that we talk about those components that actually go along yep. with the whole child welfare system.
So, Co-Chair Steiner Hayward and Senator Winters, I really appreciate those comments, and I will tell you that Ms. Al-Husseini comes from a community engagement background, and so it's a high priority for her, and she knows the importance of us engaging with communities and partners and not thinking we're in this alone and not trying to solve the problem alone. Because, again, I think I said earlier, we're not going to be successful if we think we have all the answers and we have to do it alone.
And along that line, because if I look at some of the data suggests that we're still having problems mm-hmm. with our minority community with staying longer in the system
yes.
Than what they should be staying yes. In the system. And so that project that you and I and others have been looking at with OYA, we then get a graduation into OYA and into some of the other parts of the system that we don't where we don't want children
right.
to go.
Right.
Okay, team, we need to keep moving a little bit. Representative Mueller, quick question?
Just a comment. I just encourage you along the line of questioning Senator Winters that we got to think outside the box here. What we're doing is just not working very well, and you and I have talked about that. But I really right. encourage
Absolutely.
We need to look at
yeah.
innovative pilot programs to do something different.
Yeah. Chair Senator Hayward, Representative Bueller, we've had this discussion. I couldn't agree with you more. And we need to give people, I think we need to give people at the local level kind of more flexibility and more freedom, because I'm a firm believer that the people who are actually doing the work are the people who know where the issues are and are probably the people who know what the solutions are. It's not in that building in yeah. down the street
yeah,
in Salem here.
Okay. Chair's prerogative to say one more thing, and then we need to finish up.
Okay.
I've been very patient. I let all my members go first. I want to circle way back to your response to Representative Bueller's first question about child welfare and push back a little bit.
Sure.
Which is to say, you said the problem is not enough caseworkers, not enough training to help figure out when kids need to be in or out. I would argue pretty strongly the issue is how are families getting to that place in the first place where they're actually coming to the attention of mm-hmm. child welfare, and what do we need to be doing as a state through your agency or
yeah.
Ms. Saxon's agency or any other place that we can be doing this work to prevent families from ever getting to the place, because even if you don't take the kids out, just interacting with child welfare is stressful.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so it's all very well and good, and I don't disagree with you that to say we don't have enough caseworkers and they're not well enough trained. I agree with all of that. And if we could do a better job of supporting families much earlier on and keeping them out of contact with child welfare altogether, then we know that we dramatically improve outcomes that way, and it's a heck of a lot less expensive. And we don't give kids those adverse childhood experiences that interfere with their education and their long-term physical well-being.
Yeah.
So I'm ranting a little bit, but this is something that I think it's really important to get back to root causes,
yeah.
and not enough caseworkers is not enough root cause.
So Chair Steiner Hayward and members of the committee, I apologize if I gave you the impression that those are the two things we needed to address to fix this issue, because it's a lot more complex than that. It's not just about having enough staff. It's not just about training. it's really a much more complex issue. Mm-hmm. It's really about our internal systems and processes. It's about early intervention versus taking kids into foster care. So I apologize if I gave you the impression that I thought if we fix those two things, we'd be okay, because nothing could be further from the truth. I mean, it's just multiple factors that need to be addressed. And I couldn't agree with you more. The earlier we intervene, and there are some problems inherent once you take a kid into care. It has an impact on the kid. It has an impact on the family. So really what we should be doing is really ensuring the safety of the child, but making sure that if at all possible, we don't take that child into care. So I apologize if I give you that impression.
I'm not sure that you specifically didn't say what we were talking about, but I want to be crystal clear that,
agreed,
yes, absolutely, we need to support that department well enough, but.
I agree.
Thank you. Please.
Okay. And so real quickly, I know we're running out of time. The last piece of the department is really the operations part of the department, our central services. They are kind of the business infrastructure of the department. Go ahead. And they are about 7%, $793 million. A lot of these entities also provide administrative services to the Oregon Health Authority. And really, again, just the business infrastructure provides some of those critical functions that without them, it'd be very difficult for us to do our job. Okay. And with that, we will be back tomorrow. And I will be back with Ashley tomorrow. I asked my program managers if they wanted me at the table when they presented, and you should always be careful about what you ask, because you may not like the answer. And so I will have the opportunity and the privilege of meeting with you throughout our presentation.
Great. And as a reminder to the committee, thank you very much, Mr. Seike. We'll look forward to seeing you back tomorrow, and Ms. Carson Cunningham as well. Committee, we're in H170, the small hearing room, just at the beginning of the hall over there, tomorrow and Thursday. Any other business before the committee? If not, we're adjourned.